Hi, Ray.
Hi, Jordan.
We're back. We're back in your studio. It looks really nice in here today.
It's October 19th, and it's a summer day.
It's suddenly beautiful in here. It's like we switch back after some cold days. It's really airy and nice. But if you're hearing this, obviously we took a little bit of a break, and I just kind of wanted to give an update on what's been happening. Basically, four things happened. So the number one thing is I got extremely, extremely busy with a project, which took up a lot of my time in the last couple months, and that project is done now, and I can't wait to share it with you and talk about it on the show when it comes out, which is soon. And then the second thing is I got COVID, so that took up a bunch of my time too. Actually, I had to work through it, but yeah, I was sort of sick and recovering for a little bit, but I'm fine now. And the third thing is... Well, we don't really need to talk about it that much, but the world kind of started falling apart. There's one other thing, though, that we're here to talk about, and it's pretty exciting.
You probably saw that the title of this episode is Lost Pages Found. Since this show began, we've been reading the copy of the script that has been leaked online for almost 20 years, and that copy has visible and dramatic glitches, artifacts that appear to be made by a fax machine. They devour 7 distinct sections of the script, up to 2 pages at a time, of just like horizontal glitchy black lines on an incredibly taut 89-page script in which, you know, not a paragraph is wasted. We've been saying since episode 5 to our listeners, the members of our study group.
We put the call out.
Somebody must know someone. Somebody must have a door they can knock on. Maybe somebody works at a place where there's a file that they could look through. Talk to your friends. Talk to your neighbors.
Yeah. And there's no going to the novel to fill in the gaps, because we've done that experiment before. And the same way that the Coens adapted Cormac McCarthy, they adapted James Dickey. And that doesn't mean that they like literally went novel to script literally. Like, we saw that with Muldrow's backstory, where the character grew up in Alaska, and we know that. And the Coens came through and made a flashback that was nowhere in the book. A lot of times they were externalizing that stuff in totally original scenes. So really, without these pages, there was nowhere for us to go with the show as planned.
It's like there was a DVD that people have been watching for 20 years, and it was missing about 7 minutes of an 89-minute film.
It's a lot of minutes.
It's bad. It's the status quo was a bad situation.
Yeah.
Really thought, like, let's try to get the full script. Let's try to see if it's out there and if we can get our hands on it.
And so, Ray, I'll let you do the honors. Have we found the lost pages?
We have the lost pages.
We have the pages, folks. We have them. And we're ready and we're excited for season 2 of To the White Sea. Now, Ray, how did we ever find them?
Okay, so for that, we're going to throw to an interview that we recorded a few weeks ago, right in the crunch of everything that you describe, with the member of our study group who found the lost pages, who connected the dots and figured out where these things were.
Yeah.
It was not easy to find. But anyway, to tell the full story of that, I think we're going to throw to the interview with a legendary picture editor, friend of the show, member of the study group, Kate Sanford, who is the winner of Reality, Reality winner.
She's the Edward Snowden to our Glenn Greenwald. Maybe cut that out. Kate Sanford, everybody. And after the interview with Kate, everybody stick around for a AMA mailbag, ask us anything section. Questions from the Discord answered. Yeah.
So we're here with Kate Sanford, and we just want to know, how did you find these pages? I think there's a lot that I don't know, and I've been kind of waiting until now to kind of just like, how did you do this? What happened? Thank you so much. How the hell did you do this? What happened?
Okay. Tell the story.
Well, I'm really thrilled to talk to you, and because I am a big fan of the show, and I'm a big fan of both of you, and especially since I've known Ray since he was a little kid, and I worked for his dad, who was a film editor at the time, and I was an aspiring film editor. So I got lucky enough to meet Ray's dad, John, and get hired as on my first picture apprentice job on Eight Men Out. And so Ray was actually on location with all of us. And that's where I also met your mom, Mary Cebulski, who was in the camera department at the time and then became a script supervisor. And we were all on location in Indianapolis, along with your sister, Sophie, and my mom, Midge, who was one of the producers. And this was way back in 1988. And we've all stayed friends. So that's our history. And then you and I reconnected a few years ago. And I'm a huge fan of the show. So when I heard you put out the call for Pages, I thought about who I might have a couple of degrees of separation from. And then I realized maybe I could write to my editing colleague, Trisha Cook, who is a great editor, a director, a writer, and a creative partner with her husband, Ethan Cohen. I got the Pages from Trisha. So if there is a hero in the story, it's Trisha. And, great. You know, we don't know if she's listening, but she and I have had some email exchanges, and I have been unbelievably grateful for the time and the effort that it took to do this favor for me.
Yeah.
In service of you guys, because I love the show. And by the way, I have not read the Pages because I'm enjoying having the Pages read to me 2 pages a week. Like that, I was a little skeptical at first. Like, remember I said, Ray, really 2 pages a week? Like you're going to do 90 episodes or something, or 45 episodes. And you're like, yeah, it'll be great. And it is great. So I'm enjoying it. So I haven't read ahead.
So you're in my shoes. You're on Team Jordan.
I'm on Team Jordan. It's really a delight, actually, to tune in every week and have the 2 pages read and anticipate. By the way, I'm a fan of not binging. So this goes with my, you know, like a weekly rollout. I really like that, you know, kind of that model of distribution. So anyway, I'm enjoying it. So I heard the call, sent an inquiry, explained what you guys were doing and how much I thought it was a labor of love, a really respectful and deeply analytic, dive and analysis into the Coens films and this unproduced screenplay in particular, and how much I loved it, and that I would just ask. And she wrote back and said she would ask them for the screenplay.
Wow, super cool. Ray's for Klempt. But have you met Trisha before? Like, what? How do you two go back? Like, how did you meet for the first time?
I mean, we met because she was editing Oh Brother, Where Art Thou on location in Jackson, Mississippi. And I was there as part of Tim Blake Nelson's entourage or crew, whatever you want to call it, because I was Tim Blake Nelson's editor on another movie at the same time called Oh.
Right.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about this yesterday. We were trying to figure out, it was delayed, right? Like that's how the timing doesn't make sense until you realize that Oh was delayed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So can you just fill us in on the whole situation with editing O on location?
Yeah. So Tim, I had met Tim a couple of years before that. I edited Tim's first movie called Eye of God, which was from a play that he wrote. And we were working together on that movie. And then he got, O was greenlit and he asked me to do that. So we were working on it. We started, I was trying to look this up. We started filming in early 1999. He went to South Carolina. He wrapped in March. We were editing for, I don't know, a couple of months on his director's cut. And Joel and Ethan Cohen asked him to star in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou during our post-production process. And Tim has given a lot of interviews about this, but he did hesitate when he got the offer. And he had to think about whether he could bring the goods, as he says. But he accepted. And part of the hesitation, I think, was also that we were in the midst of editing.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time, this was a studio movie. This was Miramax distributing. And there was, you know, there was like a lot of pressure on us to deliver and to get to previews and stuff. So there was a lot of post-production going on. He was like, how can we make this work? And so we talked about it, and he said, if I could get, you know, permission, would you be willing to come on location with me for a little while to Mississippi? So I said, yes. And I can't remember how many weeks Tim ended up going, but I went for, you know, a subset of that. I went for 3 weeks, maybe four at the most. And I spent most of my time editing with a, you know, an Avid that they shipped out there in a hotel room. I would visit the set. I would make VHS tapes, and I would go and bring them to him in his trailer at lunchtime, whatever his lunchtime was. And then we would view scenes, and he would give me feedback. And then I'd go back to my Avid in my hotel. And so that was basically my routine for a few weeks during, I think this was still his director's cut, which, you know, DGA is 10 weeks of a director's cut. So it was pretty intense, but I obviously got to visit the set. I got to go in his trailer. I got to see them a little bit. And yeah, it was pretty exciting.
And I have to imagine that working on an edit mobile or, you know, on location was a much different thing than it is nowadays, where you can kind of just use a laptop. Or you were showing us your sort of jump setup right before we started recording. So like, how have things changed? And then just, I guess also like, what was that like? Because he's editing his film, he's acting his heart out. Like, it seems like a lot going on at once.
Yeah, it was a big rig that they had to ship to me. I actually have a picture. I have hardly any pictures from this time. There was a pool at the hotel. So this is me.
Whoa.
Wearing a bathing suit, and that's how that cabinet.
Oh, it looks like roadie gear.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like an amp from a rock concert. It's got the same like weird handles on the side.
Yeah, it's a road case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Exactly.
Whoa.
Wow.
And there's Mekhi Phifer on that screen. But wow. this is like through glass almost, but maybe
this is a movie. There is a Mekhi Phifer.
We're looking at Kate on a Zoom window holding up a film photograph, and then we're seeing on her screen in the photograph a scan of a film clip of Mekhi Phifer.
That's really amazing. So you're like in a hotel with rock gear, going back and forth from the swimming pool to editing on like a high pressure Miramax teen Shakespeare adaptation.
Yeah.
While bringing VHSs to Tim Blake Nelson, who's, I guess, in costume and hair and makeup while he's talking to you about these cuts.
Yes. That was amazing. Wow. So I go show up. He's in stripes or he's like, you know, he's faux dirty. And he's like looking filthy, including like teeth that are painted brown. And it was pretty wild. And, you know, you guys know, and your listeners might not know, editors do not often go to set, right? We're not usually needed. There are different types of projects, but I'm not. So I would go, I would do my thing, and then I would leave, which is probably why I have so few pictures. Like the last thing I want to do is be intrusive, taking touristy pictures, you know, of my time there. But it was pretty cool. And I'll just share with you one thing that I remember, because I have a picture from the Babyface Nelson sequence. So I know I was there. And I remember Roger Deakins handing out like little shot lists to people. And I had never seen that happen before on a set, or I never even heard about that happen, that what was going to be shot that day was public knowledge. And I thought, well, why not? Like, everyone's on the crew. That makes sense. That's really like generous and probably, you know, probably more efficient and probably and very collaborative. So that was really cool.
Yeah. Almost like how actors get sides for the day. So why not give a little packet to people who are working so they understand the day?
Do you remember anything about what that shot list looked like? Or was it like sides? Was it small? Like what was on the shot list?
It was small. And I think, I mean, maybe I can ask J. Todd again, but like, I think there were pictures.
Cause that's the thing that would have jumped out to you is like the crew has the boards. Everyone knows the image that we're all trying to get to at the end.
Yeah. And also how we're going to make the day. what is it going to take to make the day? And I don't know. I feel like more information can only be extremely helpful. I got to talk with Tim a bit behind the scenes, and it was fascinating to see him switch over from being a director to being an actor and having to trust the Coens and use his intuition and his technique to figure out where he should be pitched exactly and how to calibrate the performance between comedy and genuine humanity. And he absolutely did. And then Trisha and the Coens found exactly the right balance in cutting the film. Like, when I watched it, and I just rewatched it the other day, I found his performance to be absolutely magical.
I mean, I find new things in his performance every time I watch it.
To be so blank and yet be so filled with details at the same time. I don't know how to say it. Like,
yeah, I experienced it as like he's filled with love somehow. Yeah.
That's a much better way of saying it.
Yeah. Love and just genuine humanity and honesty. But there's something about that performance that's gathers up just the beauty.
Yeah.
That is inside of him.
Yeah, and I mean he's definitely for sure from the South. But you see him in Oh Brother or The Good Girl. And then you see him in interviews and he's so urbane. He's so like collected. And it's just interesting the way that he can kind of access that good old boy characterization and kind of totally make it authentic and lived in. But then his real life personality he's a director. It's just interesting.
He's like one of the most educated people I've ever met. One of the most articulate, educated, studied classics. Went to Juilliard. I mean, the whole bit. It's so funny. I don't know. I had a renewed appreciation for it watching this time after so long. Because I saw it, a couple times way back when, but I might not have seen it for so long. And it's nice to get the distance because, I don't know about you guys, but when I have been on set at any point, there is there's sort of an extra kind of layer of meaning that I need to shed. And, there have been a couple times, like I've been a PA on a couple films where I can't even watch them because they're just a whole movie of my experience. Yeah. They're not even a film, And so Oh Brother has a little bit of a blend of that, like everything that was going on at this very heady time, this very exciting time in my life. So it was just nice to get some distance and see it as a really beautiful movie.
And then so you and Trisha, you had the same role on two different movies.
Right.
Did you connect over that or like what, how did you like actually meet on set?
Yeah, I can't remember. I wish I could remember a little bit more. But yeah, we definitely met and probably had some cordial conversations. And then over the years, we met a couple more times where we were in the same editing facility. And we have a lot of colleagues in common and a lot of connections in common. So I felt like I could write to her and reach out and ask.
Kate, you haven't read the pages, but I've now looked at everything that we have and I've seen what was missing before and what gets filled in. And it's amazing. Like the stuff that wasn't there, there's seven missing sections and they're big chunks. And so there's whole scenes, there's whole sequences, there's really memorable stuff that just wasn't in there before. And then I went and looked at our whole plan was to look at the novel and then fill it in. But it's stuff that's not in the novel too. So it really was just, it was never there before and now we can see it and it's incredible. Like the moment that I like slid it into place and it fit was like Da Vinci Code, Fifth Element, National Treasure, kind of like, oh, it's all there. You
Legends
know?
Of the Hidden Temple.
Yeah, it was incredible. Yeah, it was really such a feeling.
That's awesome. I do like a puzzle and a quest. I can't know, there's a kind of a silent nod of approval, I guess, or acceptance of the podcast by way of this kind of communication that you've gotten. I've certainly worked on a lot of projects where there's been extra textual analysis of the material. And I haven't found that there's a negative response to that stuff. I feel like there's kind of usually an appreciation for, I don't know, a serious study of that material.
A silent nod of approval.
I mean, how does that make you feel?
Kind of makes me feel like I want to speak less about it than more because it's silent, but overall good. Makes me feel good. And you know, like, you work on something really hard that you care about a lot, and the most important thing is that you care about it and that you're proud of it. But to get something kind of passed through the mail slot or found in the mailroom, like a blue letter sent to you, it's cool. It feels cool.
We want to act really cool about this, right?
Yeah.
Like, everyone be cool.
Yeah, just like everybody be cool. It's like, this is normal.
Don't freak out the Coen brothers, guys.
Just keep it chill, everybody.
Just act like this has happened before. Man, I feel like we dissociate when we try to talk about this. And we've tried to record this like 3 times now. And we're having trouble talking about the fact that Kate got in touch with Trisha Cook. And then Trisha Cook told Ethan and Joel Coen about the To the White Sea podcast. And that they rooted around in some hard drives and found this PDF.
It's like, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Just like, I kind of just feel like I'm just going to say what I want to say, which is I would rather just record the show as if we just had a PDF we downloaded off the internet and didn't get it this way.
Right. This is just what I want to talk. I just want to get a little bit of a record of this, because every time we've tried to record that we got the lost pages, I feel like we both kind of blank out.
Yeah.
I really think that me and Jordan have hit our limit of being excited about something.
Yeah.
To the point where we're oddly detached.
It's like the microphone peaked and it's all distortion.
Yeah. I mean, like, maybe a simpler way of saying this is like, I'm too happy that this happened. It's too much like antimatter. It's too fun to have these pages. And
you know what else, like, it comes to mind is that it's so hard to even encapsulate how I'm feeling now, because it's going to keep happening as we get to these sections. Like, whenever we get to one of these sections in the script, it's going to be this like exclusively gay moment in the live action Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. And maybe a different way to sit with it is just to be like, thank you. We're super thankful to Trisha Cook. We're super thankful to Joel and Ethan.
We're super thankful to the universe for making this happen. We're super thankful to the people that we are afraid to even name and mention because we're too bashful. And we're going to go back to Kate.
Oh, yeah. We're going to jump back into the Kate. But I think maybe that's the most comfortable and honest place to sit is just like.
Yeah. And I want to jump in and say, now that I have some more time on my hands, all I want to do is make this show and make it great. And I'm so excited about season 2, if that's what we're calling it, and some of the stuff we've got planned. I think you're going to love it. And I can't wait to dive in.
Yeah, we have some super cool episodes coming up, really cool guests. Okay, so now we're going to throw back to the rest of our conversation that we had with Kate. And then we're going to come back and do
some mailbag.
Mailbag. Or Discord mailbag?
Yeah, that's what it is. It's Discord mailbag. That's what it's called. Night train, mailbag, mail train. And now back to Kate.
The Wire comes to mind immediately, yeah. Like as one of the most, exactly. Like you were such a key like creative player on that project. And that's so influential and so studied.
And I think if you end up having something that becomes such a part of, you know, popular culture of the landscape, you are going to expect that there's going to be a lot of kind of participation in deconstructing and reconstructing it and pulling it apart and looking at it from different angles and different prisms. And that's just what happens. I mean, there are people who are teaching entire classes on The Wire, like their entire syllabi, you know, constructed around it. And yeah. I've read some interesting analysis of things that I've actually worked on. And I find it super interesting. And then if it's not interesting, I'm like, yeah, that's silly. But it's usually not silly. It's usually like a really interesting contribution to the conversation. Like, there's a film professor at Berkeley named Linda Williams, and she wrote a whole book about The Wire, and she's analyzing it from the perspective of it being a melodrama, which is not usually the way that people look at the series. But I think it's really interesting and definitely valid way to approach the analysis. And I really appreciate it because from the moment that I sat down at the Avid to start working on it, I found it to be kind of a melodrama, you know, and we were using, you know, a lot of like sort of editorial sort of docu-style approaches to the narrative that tried very hard to take the edge off of that melodrama. But I still, at the heart of it, I felt like it had essential melodramatic elements to it, very sentimental elements to it. So I really appreciated another analysis that looked at it from that perspective.
How many episodes of The Wire did you cut?
I think I did 19 out of 60.
Wow. Wow. So a full third. Full third of the show.
Pretty much a third. I did. Yeah. I mean, my claim is that there were a lot of editors. And the reason for that is that more than usual in the sense of a recurring television show that has multiple seasons, because The Wire did not come back at the same time every year. So there were just irregular breaks between seasons, and people were available or not available. And, you know, it's hard because if you sign on to a TV show, you know, there's a cycle to that. And then you can, you know, have a little job security and expect it's going to come back. If it doesn't come back in a timely enough fashion, like, you probably have to take another job. And then, so that happened to me. I came and went, but I always tried to come back, and I was able to come back for all five seasons and do the series finale.
That's incredible.
So I was pretty excited, and I started my first episode was the fourth episode of season one. So anyway, super lucky. I don't know, right place, right time, just when that came along.
Well, the very last episode has a lot of montage in it. Doesn't it? It ends on a montage essentially, right? And this kind of like sweeping view of all the characters that we've met and the city, and it's almost like, you know, kind of like a Baraka type
symphonic.
Yeah. So I mean, to start at the very end,
it was definitely the idea was to, it was just really a pullback. So it was a long montage that really pulled back to show the city. So, you know, it checked in with all the characters, just like every season ended with kind of a check-in to where everybody ended up in this like very wide ensemble. And so that was a motif that was established the first season and then continued until season five, when you check in with everybody to see where they ended up, where, you know, Bubbles is going upstairs finally, and who, you know, who lives, who dies, and where they end up. And then the intention was to create a montage of faces that are not the faces of our principal actors, you know, that just represent the faces of the population, of the people. So we do that. There's a rapid fire montage. And then the last face goes back to McNulty. And then the final image is a pullback on the city of Baltimore and the city skyline, because it's about the city. And so it's bookended. Clark Johnson directed that episode, and he directed the pilot as well. Oh, yeah. There's one thing I want to pitch, which is, first of all, bring Melissa back. And I think that talking about intertext is really an amazing approach, because there are so many references that they have. But something that really interests me is the play between O Brother, Where Art Thou? And the movie Sullivan's Travels, which is where O Brother, Where Art Thou? Comes from. It's definitely, I mean, it's one of my favorite movies. And these are a lot of themes that you hit upon when you were talking about Hail Caesar, because, you know, it's really about the intersection of art and commerce. This is always a question for any filmmaker who wants to express something personal and interesting. And how do you locate yourself in the capital pictures of the Hollywood machine? So, I just think that would be fun to just mention, and just kind of look at the playfulness of Sullivan's Travels, a perfect movie where Hollywood, you know, does its three-act story structure and comes back to, you know, once again, honor itself in the service of, you know, the glorious image and exalted cinema, and say that is a kind of, wait, let me just see what I wrote down. Oh, the gospel of cinema, you know, so yeah. coming full circle. So Sully's journey is, I want to make O Brother, Where Art Thou? I don't want to make Hey Hey in the Hayloft anymore. just making people laugh, you know, that's not a noble quest. I need to talk about real suffering. I need to present and bear witness to real suffering, and that kind of truth. I need to show that on the screen. And then he goes on a quest to find real suffering, and he ends up actually finding real suffering. And in the course of that, he sees people laughing at cartoons who are experiencing real deep suffering, and he realizes he hasn't experienced much suffering at all. And actually, you know, there's a lot to, and he says a line, there's a lot to be said for making people laugh. But I mean, it's just a wonderful delight of a film, but it's also Hollywood continuing to congratulate itself on providing the gospel of cinema,
right,
without, you know, necessarily tempering it with something that's also, you know, truthful, important, revelatory. And I think, you know, so your podcast and this exploration of the themes and their work, you know, it's about, I mean, about their personal expression, and they have also folded in that question mark in a lot of their films.
Yeah. It's an interesting, like, thing that they chose that title when they were also saying that they were remaking The Odyssey. It's kind of like just adding more layers to the idea that this is like their masterwork, right? But it's also kind of their most profoundly silly movie in a lot of ways too. It looks different from anything that they made before or since too.
It's wild. I mean, I was reading about, or maybe you sent me that clip about Roger Deakins talking about the post process, and
yeah,
I mean, I was literally there. It was the middle of summer. Like, it was lush and green, and you know, and then you look at it's a very strange and beautiful, I don't know, it looks kind of like a dream, because it's not desaturated in a way, and it's not necessarily realistic, but it's just unbelievably evocative. It's evocative of sepia and the depression and the time, and the South and the Dust Bowl. But if you look, I mean, the trees are in full bloom, like, everywhere.
Right. Yeah, no, as much as we like talk about digital stuff coming in and like flattening everything, I think we're very lucky that, like, the way history played out, that the first people who kind of had their hands on these tools on like a big canvas was Deakins and the Coens.
Yeah.
Kind of making a statement about what, I don't know if it was the Da Vinci or what they were using, but like making a statement about what you could do, like the expressive power of those digital tools.
Well, do you want to ask me about, cause there's some.
Yeah. Do those, Jordan. Okay. You found all the actors.
I have a list here of, I'm a huge fan of Show Me a Hero. I think that's like a really, to be honest, like a kind of an underseen masterpiece. And it's like, but then also when you watch it, you understand why, because it's basically about like Yonkers zoning. It's like David Simon doing, but it's so fascinating and such a great character piece. And so obviously it stars Oscar Isaac, who kind of blew up through Llewyn Davis. So I guess, like, what's it like to get dozens of hours of Oscar Isaac raw footage?
Well, he's, you know, in the particular case of Oscar Isaac, he is so brilliant that I probably did nothing. Like, it's not a performance that needed to be sculpted in the editing room. It's not something that needed to be found. There are certain complex, nuanced performances that you really have to dig for, and this was not one of them. When I heard he was cast, I thought, well, this is going to be great. This is going to be powerful. And I already loved him from Llewyn Davis. So it's just incredibly fortunate. I don't know who else could have played that role and brought such, you know, like wonky material to life. Because it is so dry and specific. So I don't know. We just loved him from the first frame. So like there's not a variation in performance from A to Z. It's like A mm-hmm. to C. So he just knew who that was. And we kind of followed, you know, we just followed his performance. So it's just, so I don't know. I have just tremendous awe, for Oscar Isaac, and he had such tremendous focus. It was a very hard shoot. I think it was 73 days to do this limited series and something around that. All of them were shot by Paul, directed by Paul Haggis. You know, there was an intensity to the whole thing. That was very hard, shot out of sequence. Right. So,
Oh wow. They block scheduled the
block scheduled them. Wow. Yeah. So like all the courtroom scenes, you know,
whoa.
So that's hard. That's hard to locate your performance.
Yeah. That's a 7-hour movie basically, or an 8-hour movie. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Could we switch? Could I ask you another Coen's gem, Tony Shalhoub in Ms. Maisel?
Yeah.
Tell us about cutting some Shalhoub.
I just love him. I don't even know what to say. I mean, we just love him. I mean, the Maisel world is, you know, it's sort of like a Preston Sturges world. You know, it's fast and it's precise and it's silly and it's funny, and you know, he just nailed it. I think it's interesting from the pilot to the rest of the series. I feel like his character softened a little bit, which was intentional. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's a hardness at the beginning that is harder to sustain, and you know, you want to lean into likability. But I think I don't know. I think he's brilliant and funny. All of these actors have the amazing ability to like memorize pages and pages of dialogue.
Yeah.
And also he had to be word perfect. That's one thing I will add about Maisel, is that being on book was essential. They were very precise about every word. And if they didn't get every word, you know, we would choose a take where they got it right. So it wasn't only the spirit of it. It was really the letter of the language. Mm-hmm. And
because they want to have that like kind of crackling, kind of like sort of screwball comedy kind of dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. And the rhythm, and like the rhythm of that. The rhythm of that show was as important as, I mean, that was content, I think. So I certainly felt that way. And that it seemed like it was as important to Amy and Dan, the showrunners and the writers, directors, mm-hmm. as, you know, as the performance, just getting that ping pong mm-hmm. back, and, you know, just precisely perfect. And it was so important to them that there was an extra script supervisor whose job was to stay on book, to help them stay on book. Because you, as one script supervisor, it's very hard to watch everything visually that's going on and catch words that may have been dropped inadvertently or changed or whatever, or transposed.
Right. It's like the same way that a DP has to think about like the camera and the lights. It's like if you're thinking about continuity and dialogue, but that really could be two separate jobs.
Yeah. So there was a precision that was required. And that brings us to Max Casella, right? He's also in Maisel.
Well, you're one step ahead of me. Yeah. Tell us about Casella on vinyl.
Oh my God. I mean, I love Max Casella. I actually cut him. He was in Boardwalk Empire. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm sorry, Max. I got to go back to, he might have been a friend of a director I was working with, Michael Corrente, or maybe he had a part in a Michael Corrente movie. I mm-hmm. can't quite remember. But I had met him way back in the day before that. And sort of every time I see him, I am grateful that he gave me house seats to see The Lion King when he was in it.
Wow.
Was he like Timon or Pumbaa?
He was Timon.
Yeah.
Whoa. It makes sense.
He's on the cast album.
Yeah.
Whoa. Rosen he was original Kranz Broadway cast?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Wow, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Max Casella.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whoa.
He's brilliant. Yeah.
What a time that must have been. To like.
I think he's having Max a time. Casella. I think he's having a time every day of his life. That's my guess.
Yeah. No, he's just great. But he has more of a range of performance.
Yeah, that's great you bring that up, because I was going to ask you if there's an actor, because for Shalhoub and for Isaac, you're saying they're so on that you don't have to do much, but maybe Casella's a great example. Like, what's it like when you have an actor who's trying different things every single time, or is a little bit more, I know the word method is very like loaded, so I'm not saying he is a method actor, but someone who really tries to, you know, use whatever's in front of them and maybe see if they get inspired different ways. Like, yeah, that must be difficult though, or maybe it's inspiring. I don't know.
Well, it's a little harder, right? I mean, it's just, you have more choices. And so that just multiplies the permutations of what you can do. And so I'll do different versions. Let's say for someone like Max, like he's very expressive. He's incredibly funny. He can be very big and broad, or he can be a little quieter and more precise. So there's definitely a range in there, and I will try. I'll try a lot of things. I'll try to get to the edge of the bigness, right? I'd try to just get to it, just where beyond that would be too much. But we want to use all of his comic abilities and timing in service of the piece and the story without going over into, you know, more farcical or, you know, or beyond the tone of the piece itself. Anyway, nothing but respect. Oh, and then, yeah, and then Vinyl. Vinyl also, because I was thinking of Maisel when I said all that, but I mean, that's just true. That's just true of Max anyway.
What about cutting Griffin in Vinyl? What was that like? our Muldrow. Yeah.
I know. I just have to say the best things about Griffin.
Because we love cutting Griffin's performances too. Yeah, for the show.
Because we
yeah.
love Griffin. I love meeting him. I mean, he didn't have a huge part. I think Griffin was mostly in those board meeting scenes in the American Century record office. He was in a lot of ensemble scenes, so I think he had a smaller role. For me, you know, again, that was a lot of that was about the rhythm of everyone kind of building off of each other, you know, and especially off of Bobby Cannavale, who's basically leading those scenes and everyone yeah. sort of reacting and calling out and stuff.
You edited how many episodes of Boardwalk Empire?
A lot.
You edited a lot of Buscemi.
Almost half, probably, yeah.
The bulk of the series, to quote Big Lebowski.
Sidney Wolinsky edited the pilot. Tim Strito and I edited the rest of the series. And yeah, we kind of alternated.
So what was it like working with Buscemi's footage?
Buscemi's, he's amazing. I mean, he's just absolutely spot on, you know, all the time. I wouldn't say there's the most extreme variation in his performance, but it's more subtle. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think you're looking for little gems, little eye, you know, just movements of his eyes, just very precise, small movements of his body to express what's going on. So I think it, you know, it felt like very careful and, you know, detailed work. Back in the, you know, when I started, you know, late 80s, early 90s, I mean, there weren't that many different post-production facilities. So the Brill Building was sort of the premier gathering place for features. And so everyone was cutting there. So John Sayles was there. Martin Scorsese was there. Jonathan Demme. You know, pretty much everybody. And there were a couple of other facilities. This was on 49th and Broadway. The building's still there, and it still says Brill Building. And I think previously and maybe concurrently with in its early history, it was a place where songwriters were housed and wrote like a lot of tradition, you know, famous Tin Pan Alley songs. So it, you know, it even sort of its history and its allure even predates the film editing world. But by the time I got there, it was mostly an editing and a mixing facility. So you could not only rent rooms for picture editing, for sound editing, but you also had ADR studios, mixing studios, all housed in the same building. And it was just really exciting to walk down the halls, and everyone in their room was working on a different movie. And to go back to your earlier point, Jordan, about being an assistant, like, it was pretty exciting to be an assistant. You could meet all the other assistants. You could, you know, brush shoulders with the filmmakers. You might find yourself, you know, in the elevator with somebody famous. And it was very exciting and inspiring.
No, I remember there was one summer that my dad was working there, and the Coens were editing Big Lebowski, and they were in the building a lot. And I think Tom DiCillo was editing Living in Oblivion at that time, and Scorsese was there doing Kundun. Mm-hmm. And it was always like the elevator would open up and it'd be like Scorsese and like four monks in like those orange robes.
Wow.
You know, and they just like come out of the elevator together. And it was like,
so that right there, not like film Twitter needs to be like fact checked, because we know that they're wrong about a lot of things, but like all this stuff about like, wow, how did it take Scorsese so long to be culturally sensitive? You know, he has to, like, only now does he realize he needs to tell you know, people's stories properly. Like, we have eyewitness testimony that Scorsese was bringing in monks for
to sound one.
Yeah, for screenings in the Brill Building.
Are you guys looking forward to Killers of the Flower Moon?
Oh yeah, very much. Yeah, I love always to see everything. I just rewatched Irishman, and like, I mean, my takeaway from it, I think this was the third or fourth time seeing it, and I did see it. Did actually get to see it in theaters, which was a real treat, because there was a lot of supporting actors and like background players who were in the audience, just loving it. Mm. I mean, my main takeaway from that movie is just that I like a lot of movies that are long, but they all feel long. That movie feels like it's an hour and 40 minutes every time I watch it. I just, wow, like, I don't feel the length of that movie at all. I think it's like just brilliantly constructed, and it's so gripping and so moving, and De Niro's performance, like, you know. So yeah, which is all to say, like, I think Scorsese's still at the top of his game, and I can't wait to see the next one.
Yeah. These days I'm really, really into the sequence from Hugo where Ben Kingsley is playing Méliès, and he's like, it's like the flashback to like the go-go, like the salad days. Like, super, super into that, and always just like continue to be super obsessed with the Nick Nolte painting movie.
That's what, like, I was going to bring up.
What are you going to say?
That's what I was going to say. Conquistador, Whiter Shade of Pale, those are the most beautiful montages, and I watch them all the time from Life Lessons. If I want to be inspired by camera movement, rhythm and editing and emotion, they're really the gold standard.
Yeah, if anyone hasn't seen Life Lessons, it's one part of the New York Stories triptych, and it's my definitely my favorite score. It's the Scorsese film I've watched the most times, and the one that,
yeah,
when I'm on set, I'm always thinking about, like, well, what would the shot look like if it was part of Life Lessons?
Right, and maybe like for people who are getting started or working on short films, like, it's a great example of like firing on all cylinders.
It's a character based short film, yeah.
You guys, I should probably go pretty soon. Okay. Sorry, because I love talking to you. The only thing I'm going to say, and in conclusion, is like, it would be amazing to go deep into their editing process at some point. That would be really cool, because they are such good editors. And I'm not usually a fan of directors cutting their own films, but in this case, I really am.
Roderick James knows what he's doing.
Roderick James.
So you're pitching us a prism in the future where we really focus on editing for an episode.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Editing and camera angles too. And I sent that video on Discord that I thought was really instructive and helpful.
Absolutely. Well,
thank you for joining the Discord also. Yeah. I really, really thank you for coming out to the Xander screening and for joining the Discord and being such a good member of the study group and all the, you know,
sure.
My whole understanding of like real professionals making films is like, you're one of the absolute first people I met Like just like, you know, but that world has always felt really filled with like happy, kind, like living people. I think in part because you're one of the first people I met, like you and Tim Squires, and just the way that you created this environment around my dad. Just being a kid in the Brill Building is not the easiest experience in the world. And you always just made me feel really at home and really safe just being around people that were just working so hard on stuff that they're so passionate about. So I was really surprised that the pages got to us this way, but it makes a lot of sense to me when I think about like, my life and just what I love about filmmaking. Yeah.
Aw. Yeah. Thanks, Ray. It's just really great to connect with you. And yeah, I'm glad I could help. And my life is very much enriched by listening to you guys every week. So I thank you for that.
That's very nourishing. So we'll keep at it.
Now we really have to finish the show.
we got to get all the way through. So, we got nothing to stop us.
Yeah. We will follow through all the way to the end.
We're going to head into another section now. It's the To the White Sea mailbag. And we got some questions from you in the Discord. And here we go.
Can you explain to anyone who's not on our Discord, which is the vast majority of our listeners, what is a Discord?
A Discord is basically just a chat room. It's like a collection of chat rooms. It's basically a place you can come and you can chat. We have different channels. We have general, which is pretty much just talking about whatever we talk about on the show. We've got other movies, which is if you want to talk about movies other than the Coens. We have a really, really cool part of the Discord, actually, is Prism clips, where you can actually see all the clips that we watch. And these are, generally speaking, like the exact clips that we watch right before the show. So
if you want the full custom tailored experience where you hear us describing a scene and you're watching that exact scene, it's all there. Every episode.
It's been updated. It's on Mega Upload. Thank you, Kim.com. Great friend. Jimmy Goldblum. Hey, Jimmy. Jimmy Goldblum asks, there are more than a few unproduced scripts from great directors floating around. So of all the directors in all the lands, why the Coens? Why this story? I think this is a script that I've thought about for probably longer than any unproduced script I can think of. Like we started the show off, me talking about Ain't It Cool News. That site was a big part of my life, as I think it was for a lot of film nerds who are about to turn 40. I thought, you know, I remember reading a report about it, and I've thought about it ever since. And then it's just such a complete work, right? Like, isn't that kind of part of it, is that the Coens themselves have such an amazing body of work, and this fits so cleanly into the middle of their career. It feels almost real when we talk about it. There's other unproduced scripts out there that are super interesting. There's the George Miller Justice League script comes to mind. There's the Avatar unproduced sequel, which got turned into a comic book. There's the Charlie Kaufman musical about movie bloggers. Those are other interesting projects.
What is that Charlie Kaufman project? What do you know about that?
I know that it also came very close to being produced in a similar time frame as this, or maybe a little bit, no, more like mid-2000s. I think Jack Black was going to be in it. I mean, I haven't read it. I've only read like the first like 20 pages, but my understanding is it's about sort of the different styles of desperationness, like the different styles of desperateness and patheticness of like the awards circuit and movie bloggers, like how people on the inside and people on the outside, people in movies and people watching movies, all have a certain shared sadness and awkwardness about them. And they interact in weird ways over the internet.
And it's a full musical? They break into song?
This I don't know because I haven't read the whole thing, but I do know that there's musical elements. And I know that he, I believe he like toyed with the idea of there being musical sections of Synecdoche. Like they have that, like they have, there are songs in Synecdoche. Like the end credits has a song. Like he's like wants to make musicals. Like he's a person who like lives in that space, but hasn't actually made a musical. I think kind of similar to the Coens, you know, the Coens like love musicals and made sort of a quasi musical with Hail Caesar. Lebowski also obviously doesn't have any like musical sequences, but it has scenes that feel like a Busby Berkeley movie. So yeah, that's like another interesting.
The Buster Scruggs short is I think that's technically a musical.
Yeah, no,
completely right.
Absolutely, yeah, no, it hadn't come to mind. It wasn't on the tip of my tongue, but yeah, the Scruggs is a full musical. The short itself is a full musical. It contains 3 songs that all like fit into
their narrative pillars.
Yeah, they're narrative pillars. They form the basis of the story and character. So absolutely a musical without question. Does that answer the question? Why the Coens? What does this question make you think of, right?
Well, first off, it just makes me think of other unproduced scripts that you and I have talked about in the past. I'm specifically super fascinated by the cheapest Muppet movie ever made, the like 2010 Frank Oz, whatever was being developed in that era for that idea, before they went with the Jason Segel Muppet reboot. That is a script that I no one has that. It's not leaked yet. Hopefully. Mm-hmm. I hope it does one day, because that has a similar kind of like the idea is so high concept. Like the conceit of To the White Sea, the Coens, who are these unparalleled at vocabulary and language and voice, doing a movie with no talking is like about as much of a high wire act as the cheapest Muppet movie ever made. Do you know the idea of it, basically?
Tell us about it.
All I know is that they blow the entire budget of the film in the first like 6 minutes. And then the rest of the film is incredibly lo-fi and bare bones because they're like, we have no money left.
That's great.
Yeah. It sounds really avant-garde, you know? And also like, the Muppets are broke. That's the most important thing about a Muppet film, is that their main problem is that they're broke. This is like classic. So this is like finding the core and just honing right in on it. So yeah, I would love to read that. I also know Nabokov did the first draft of the Lolita adaptation for Kubrick, and it's in a library somewhere. You can read it in an archive. I forget which one. But it's supposed to be like 900 pages, and it's got as much split screen as Ang Lee's Hulk, which we saw the other night.
So that's more pages than the novel.
Yeah.
That's like, I guess maybe if you took every scene and every line of dialogue from like a 500 page novel and you wrote it with like final draft line spacing.
Yeah.
That's how long.
But yeah, but full like, you know, kaleidoscopic juxtapositions.
I'd love to see that. I'd love to read that. I'm not sure if I'd like to see that. I don't think that doesn't sound very adaptable.
Well, how long is 900 pages?
900 is divisible by 60. I will say that.
Right. It's like,
yeah,
it's 10 hour and a half movies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
the
easy way to think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Also, I do have a copy of the Nick Cave Gladiator 2 script.
Wow.
Which is really, really crazy. And I believe ends in the future, or at least in modern day.
Oh, hell yeah.
In modern day, high tech, like a burn after reading type situation. I think it ends like either in the CIA or in the future.
I love when high fantasy series are like, we're out of ideas. Let's go do the future version. I think that's sick.
Do you have any good examples or what comes to mind?
Some Zelda stuff is is kind of like that. I think the Final Fantasy series has done a lot of that. I'm not that familiar with that game series.
But then also, yeah, you mentioned the George Miller Justice League. I think also I have a copy of the Robert Smigel Green Lantern script, which is, I'll just say there's amazing Green Lantern scenes written. Like George Miller and Robert Smigel both totally got their hands around to like what is cool, what's so Harold in the Purple Crayon, like about that character.
Wow.
So those are interesting to compare and contrast. And I think, yeah, Smigel is just such a, like such a completely creative.
He's a deeply visual thinker. As much as he can write amazing one-liners, he's also, like if you watch TV Funhouse, it's like, what's inside the snake? And every single time it's just rats in the shape of something.
Yeah, that script rules. I know speaking of Ang Lee, there was a Magnetic Fields musical that Ang Lee was developing that there's stuff out there for. I think there's a draft of the script. And it was like 69 Love Songs era Magnetic Fields. Like, so that, like, basically everything that they had recorded up until then, kind of like a jukebox musical about like a band that I guess some people cared about. I guess they had like crossed over at that point with that triple CD.
It sort of seems like musicals are a high concept idea that you could take really far. And then at a certain point, people are like, is this going to be a complete catastrophe?
Those are some other unproduced scripts that I'm super fascinated. But to the White Sea, reasons to do it in this format. Number one, no dialogue means it's really nice to have it read to you because it's just kind of like having a prose. For the most part, it's just action descriptions. This guy goes over here, he picks up this, he looks at it, he puts it down, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think any Coen script would be really nice to have the action descriptions read to you because they pick really, really beautiful words and they just have a funny, graceful and kind of loose and precise way of describing things really, really vividly, but very concisely. So it's super fun. Some of the other scripts I've mentioned, like I have, you know, after reading To the White Sea for a while, you go and read what passes for action descriptions in those scripts and you're like, this is really ugly utilitarian writing. So it's fun to listen to.
Yeah, great scripts. Scripts for great movies are not always great pieces of written English and wouldn't necessarily like be fun to listen to as a radio play. But the Coens write in a certain way that's very literary. I mean, we talked about that with Melissa, like just like a reference to the Inferno in the description. So I think that's another thing too, is it's just like the quality of the material itself as a document to share with the world is another reason that this is a cool script to focus on specifically.
Well, I also think just the rapid turnover of the kind of predicament that he finds himself in and how much it's constantly just moving from, you know, you're in hot water, you get out of it, you find yourself in different hot water, strategize. That strategy takes you so far. And then early on, I started to break it into 2-page chunks and was like, each one of these is like a little action film with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Totally. Like, I'm sure there's an amazing unproduced Richard Linklater script out there. I don't know what it does. Nothing comes to mind, but I'm sure there's many of them. But the problem with that script, if it exists, is we would probably be like swimming in dialogue scenes for weeks at a time, just based on how those movies go. And so like, it would be hard to be like, well, this week we're talking about Ethan Hawke's, I don't know. You get what I'm saying.
You're imagining like a 6-page scene in Boyhood where they're like sitting in a bowling alley and we read 1/3 of that scene.
Yeah.
And we have a guest on to talk about that third of that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Not a dilemma that we've had to deal with very much.
We're going
to
what?
Like early on, we were in the chin-up contest for a few episodes. And that was that. Thanks for the question, Jimmy.
Great question, Jimmy. Thank you so much.
Emilio. Hey, Emilio. Emilio asks, if someone else was to pick up To the White Sea and direct it, who would you like it to be? Would you want someone to rewrite it and make it their own, or use the version you are reading from? Well, I think we've answered the question about who we think would be really good for this. And the answer I think we came up with together was Verhoeven, just in terms of his connection to World War II and the ambition of the movies that he makes and how precise and visceral every shot is, in a way that I think is similar to the Coens and also super different. And I think, yeah, I think if he were to make it, it would be interesting to see like what he would do, maybe him and a writer would do with this material. But I guess selfishly, if someone else were to direct this movie, I still would want to see it as close as possible to the written version, like done to its...
You'd want to see Paul Verhoeven directing a Coen Brothers script?
I think so, yeah. I think
yeah,
so.
Yeah, well, I guess why not, right?
Yeah.
Like, what would that be like?
Yeah. But I also, yeah, I think if a great filmmaker took this project on, it would also be their prerogative to make changes that would like more suit where they would want it to go.
I know a friend of the show, David Lowery, definitely developed his own version of To the White Sea with his own script. Did not read the Coens script. Was adapting the book, and that sounds sick.
Like, that's fascinating.
Would like to see that for sure.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about that.
We'd love to hear about that for sure. I was also thinking about Witness.
Oh yeah,
and Master and Commander.
Yeah,
and thinking about that kind of zone of Peter Weir.
Yes,
handling To the White Sea, a kind of a coldness, but a like a focus, you know, in the storytelling.
Yeah.
But also with like either, you know, some of those murders, some of that tension in Witness makes me think about like incredibly intimate, super scary scenes from To the White Sea. But then some of the Master and Commander, like really big scale special effects, action sequences, historical action sequences make me go like, okay, some of these bigger kind of poetic scenes from the script, like he'd be able to like have both of those just like land in a super kind of tangible.
Yeah.
His movies. Yeah. I just feel like you feel very present.
Yeah. And I feel like for Verhoeven or Weir, they're good answers to that question, because they could have either done it in the early 2000s or they could do it today. Like they could do it in the context, like they could do it in a similar industrial context to how the movie was originally going to be produced, or they could do it like the Apple TV version with a bunch of CG or whatever it would take. Thanks for the question, Emilio.
Emilio, I was listening to an old Blank Check the other day and I heard them mention you for like the first time. It was hilarious.
Yeah, shout out Emilio from the Can I Kick It podcast. We guess it on there. And I actually got to hang out with him in New York when he was here for a day. And just a great, great guy. And awesome member of the study group. We actually have another question from Emilio. When reading a script for the first time, are you visualizing every second of it? Or do you just take in the story? Same question for a novel. Do you want to visualize the whole thing or just take in the prose?
I'm an incredibly slow reader. Most importantly for me is to make a list of the characters. That's really when I'm reading. I'm mostly keeping track of who is who, because I find when I can't see the people's faces, I get very swimmy, unless I'm like, okay, this person is this person's sister. This person used to be this person's boss, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, what's funny is I've never done that before, and I have the same problem. I think it would help me a lot because I'm trying to read more, and I think like a list of characters would be helpful.
I just remember like you get like a play, and it says who the characters are.
Like, this is her sister. This is her father.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I make a little one, you know.
Yeah.
Something like that for myself, basically.
Yeah, I think I am visualizing things to some extent. It depends on how the script is written, though. Because some scripts don't give you a lot of visuals, or sometimes the script gives you so much information that you like almost want to tune it out. Like when I see like a scene description paragraph that's like what everyone's wearing, sometimes I'll just be like, oh, I'm skipping that. And then I realize they did it for a reason, or I got confused. So it has to be the right level of specificity, but also not a barrage of details that don't matter for me to, I think, properly visualize a movie. But yeah, if I can, I would say that it's, if I'm not visualizing a movie, it's harder for me to read the script and I don't get as much out of it.
I feel like I definitely over maybe like, or I'm like, I can get too lost in it if I'm just reading it, all the details.
Yeah.
I find, and we've done this together, when you've brought in drafts of narrative scripts that you've written, I'll ask you, can we read it together, like as a play?
Yeah.
And I get to play the main character and some other characters too. But like, definitely, like I would like, if I'm going to read a friend's script, it's really, really helpful if we can read it together out loud in one pass. So it's kind of like watching a movie where you just sit down and you're captive to kind of the flow of it. And you know when it's going at a good speed and when it's getting draggy. And then also, yeah, it's really helpful for me to be just like rooted right in the protagonist as I'm reading it. Just be like, this felt awesome when I got to say this, finally, after all the tension had built up.
Yeah. I think it's a really good answer, which is basically visualizing stuff in your head, whether or not you're doing it, might be not the best path to actually getting a script realized mentally. Like the best way to, like a table read, like a group table read, getting people together and having each person play a character feels more like an evocation of what that script is trying to get across. Jason, friend of the show, Jason Katzenstein says,
amazing cartoonist, brilliant friend.
He's a brilliant cartoonist and an amazing friend. Jason asks, since the beginning of the show, which Coens has changed for you the most? I have a very concrete answer to that, and it's Oh Brother. Because I was really walking around not liking that movie for a long time and thinking it didn't really hit in terms of like how broad the humor was and whether the characters were well drawn, and like whether it really cohered as a story. And if you listen to this show in real time, I think you'll be able to hear me kind of get to that place. And I don't think I really was fully around to it till we did Liz's episode, Open World. And I think it was just about breaking it down.
I don't know if I have just one, but the ones that moved super, super big for me. Well, first off, I just could not watch Lady Killers without having a gag reflex. And so that's a pretty big shift from not being able to like hold it in my hand without it shocking me.
Yeah.
To, I like that movie a lot, actually, now.
I like a lot of that movie a lot. Too.
I think it's like, I think the film is it's like irredeemable, but they're just the, yeah, I have real love in my heart for it. And I also, you know, Intolerable Cruelty, like I also like, I found a genuine, my hooks into those movies are so genuine.
I think like when we've grappled with them, we've come to understand a lot more of how they function.
I'm saying my hooks aren't intellectual. They're just purely like, I like this.
Okay.
I really like this part of this movie, or I like the way this movie does this thing. So Man Who Wasn't There, we did the rewatch before we went on Can I Kick It? And that was a breakthrough for me. That was really, that was one where it went from like, I know that's a good, well-made movie to this is like a secret garden that I can hang out in forever.
Yeah, I would actually put that. I would put that on the list too for me. It's like it's a different thing of going from not liking to liking, but going from a movie where I'm like, yeah, that's one of their good movies, to realizing it's as good as anything they've ever made and possibly the most beautiful film that Deakins shot for them.
And in the lead up to recording the first episodes of this show, I did like a rewatch of everything, and that was like True Grit. I had like an ecstatic, super, I was super, super surprised by how my True Grit rewatch went. And then every time I've seen it since then, I just like, I used to think of that as like a very bland, like that's the one that they did for the masses movie. Yeah. And I just like, yeah, I think you could just set your watch by that movie.
Can I say that I'm actually still there?
You with know, what?
With True Grit. Like, it's not that, well, not exactly there. I don't think it's bland at all, but True Grit is the one that does not come to mind for me when I think of the Coens. Like, literally, when you say True Grit, I'm like, oh, yeah, True Grit.
Well, how many times have you watched it?
I've probably rewatched True Grit fewer times than most of the other movies we've talked about. I can't think of another one. Maybe Blood Simple. I've rewatched less.
I watched it in here on the projector, like super big one night, straight through. And it's just, you get invested in those characters and it takes you all the way through the end.
Another question from Jason. Here's a debate I want to hear. Going from Sonnenfeld to Deacons feels to me akin to when a band changes their lineup. Which band shakeup is the best analog to this DP change? So Sonnenfeld to Deacons. Sonnenfeld is to Deacons as, you know.
Yeah.
But with pop music. What do you got, Jordan?
I have two answers. One is Sonnenfeld reminds me a lot of Prince Paul working with De La Soul. Just sort of his bombastic, playful energy, kind of grabbing anything he can and making it work. And then when they did Stakes Is High, they made a more restrained, like more sort of, I guess you could say traditional hip hop record. But I don't know who the producer of Stakes Is High is, so it's not a complete analogy. And then the other answer I have is Genesis. I feel like Sonnenfeld is very much the Peter Gabriel to Deacons, Phil Collins. So that's my answer.
Those are brilliant answers. Can you drop in little music cuts of all of those,
yeah,
all of those changes
so yeah,
you can see how it's like the cinematography?
Yeah.
All I could really think of is that scene from Some Kind of Monster where Robert Trujillo tries out for Metallica.
I've never seen that movie. I know it's an amazing doc.
Oh, it's like the greatest. That is the greatest film ever made. Like, very arguably.
All right, I'll have watched it the next time we record.
Yeah.
Let's put a pin in that.
I don't think you can watch that movie and not behave differently for like 4 days afterwards. it makes you reconsider almost everything you say.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's relevant to Lebowski, too.
Oh, yeah. You can really imagine him with those guys.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. What year was Some Kind of Monster?
The whole Napster stuff is happening while
the film
is being shot.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's got to be like 99, right, something like that.
Right, right, right.
I also remember one time Andrew WK joined Bonnie Prince Billy for a while and was playing piano. And suddenly they just got way louder.
Uh-huh. That kind of feels like Janusz. That's like Janusz joining Burn After Reading.
Wait, who shot up Burn After Reading?
Isn't it Janusz Kaminski?
Was it?
I think so. Or was it Chivo?
This is what I'm unsure of now. I'm genuinely unsure.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm not sure either. That kind of reminds me of Emmanuel Lubezki, Chivo joining Burn After Reading. Yeah. Just doesn't hit as hard as the Janusz version. Rumblefish asks, are there any other novels the Coens have considered adapting? Or alternatively, what other novels should the Coens adapt?
Well, I'm not sure if that dark web script that they wrote was based off of a book, or was it based off of like a series of articles?
Yeah, I believe it was based on journalism, but not sure.
What about the Skidoo? What's that Skidoo script?
Yeah, 62 Skidoo.
Is that based off of a book?
I don't think so.
Oh, this is a thing. There was the show where Anna Melissa was performed for the first time. That night, also, something called Sawbones was performed starring Philip Seymour Hoffman as Sawbones, his character Sawbones. It sounded really funny. We got to find a copy of Sawbones.
We got to find a copy of
now
Sawbones.
Now that we got these missing pages,
yeah,
we got to move on to the Sawbones crisis. It's a crisis.
Sawbones.
And it needs to end.
Yeah. Performed in its entirety by Ben Hosley as Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Steve Buscemi, Marcia Gay Harden, Philip Seymour Hoffman, John Goodman, John Slattery, written by Joel and Ethan. In Sawbones, it turns out that the crusty Westerners are actually on a TV show that's playing as a backdrop and a counterpoint to the domestic difficulties of a married couple who are addicted to watching it. The show Sawbones.
Whoa.
A fictional Western show. What's the show that they love so much? O Troop?
F Troop.
F Troop.
Did you watch that on Nick at Night?
No.
Oh, I watched that a lot. It's just like a very goofy, broad, like slapstick show, I guess set in a war, but I can't remember the like time period. Kind of had a Western vibe to it too. But it's funny. There's a great like academic paper I found that we should talk about in another episode about Serious Man, but they make the connection between F Troop and when Clive says, F, the failing grade.
Oh my God.
I don't think that's an accident.
Anyway, it seems like Sawbones is set half in the world of this TV show called Sawbones and half, but it's a radio play. So Joel's saying he thought it'd be interesting because you can't see anything that you can't tell that one's coming from the TV and one's coming, like one strand of dialogue is people watching the TV and the other was the people inside the TV.
That's cool.
Some heady stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, there is a recording because it was played on the radio, so someone must have recorded it. There has to be a bootleg out there.
Oh, we gotta get
that we could listen to of Sawbones, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman.
We gotta listen to Sawbones. I gotta be honest with you, Ray. This question has haunted me because I have not read a novel in too long. Last novel I read that comes to mind is by Michelle Houellebecq. Who is racist. And if I'm honest, I would like to see a Coen Brothers adaptation of The Map and the Territory, but I have instituted a new rule in my life because of this question. And the rule is I'm not going to have my phone in my bedroom when I'm falling asleep, and I'm going to read books. This is a new rule. So I'd like to thank Rumblefish for the crisis of you know, self-worth. And I promise to do better.
Yeah. The Discord is where you can hold a mirror up to the hosts of the show.
Seriously.
That they cannot stand their own reflection in.
Absolutely. Join the Discord.
This is a book I read a few years ago. It's called Island in the Sea of Time. And it's a sci-fi book. And it's basically about the island of Nantucket in the middle of the night transports through time to the Bronze Age. And so everyone in Nantucket wakes up in the morning. This is in 1998. And they just like the island is all still the same. Everyone's like phones work and everything and they can all talk to each other. But just beyond Nantucket is like crazy Bronze Age warriors and like barely civilized people.
Sounds sick.
Yeah, it was a great book.
And sounds like the Coens might enjoy that material.
Well, the best scenes are the scenes of like the people in Nantucket, like back in their houses, like using their problem solving skill set to like figure out, because they do have a lot of resources. You know, they're all together and they have nice houses and they have such advantages over these Bronze Age people that even though they're like completely surrounded on the planet alone, it's like, there's also, I think there's an aircraft, carrier that also goes through the same time tunnel. So it's like basically Nantucket and I guess the military. Wow. Are the two things that are sent from 1998 back in time, which I guess is a pretty good pairing, actually.
I'm amazed that movie hasn't been made. That's a great concept for a movie that seems like, what was that called again?
Island in the Sea of Time. It's a first of a three-part series called the Nantucket series.
Nice.
I always love like books that were clearly written, like, or like they had the idea on vacation, and you can just like you got them in the crosshairs. I feel like Jurassic Park is like a big like okay buddy,
we get it. You went to an island.
Yeah, you had you had some free roaming creative juice when you were like in Costa Rica, and your mind was wandering.
Thanks, Rumblefish. Patrick O'Connor asks, haven't heard Tragedy of Macbeth come up on the podcast, unless I missed that somewhere.
We discussed it on the Liz episode.
That's right.
On Open World.
Yeah. Yeah. But not as a clip that we chose. It's come up here and there. We have not, I believe, chosen a clip from it, which is interesting because the opening of Macbeth is almost a visual match for the opening of To the White Sea. The way that the, like, seabird comes out, or the way that a bird flying around kind of resolves itself out of like a white void. But I think the truth is that, at least from my perspective, I still don't have a strong take on that movie. And I actually went back and I watched it after reading Patrick's question.
It went nuts on the Discord for a while with Macbeth. It was an all Macbeth Discord.
Yeah.
Before it turned into a Commedia dell'arte Discord.
Yeah. Great conversations happening on the Discord. Seriously, like if you want to know about the state of the art of Commedia dell'arte in Los Angeles, or if you want to know about different adaptations of Macbeth and how they differ,
because we were looking at stuff from the Orson Welles Macbeth, which I really love, and I think that one is black and white and super funky and super emotionally bizarre in the way that the Joel one is. I think they look really nice together.
Yeah. And Throne of Blood too. The Kurosawa.
Oh my God. Macbeth. I didn't even think of Throne of Blood.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
I feel so stupid. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's clearly in conversation with those. And I honestly think I have to watch the Orson Welles one and the Throne of Blood one to have an opinion. I think that's the real answer is, I don't have a strong opinion. I think it's beautifully shot. And I want to understand the play too.
The Assassin's Creed version is incredible to watch.
Yeah.
Like in comparison with Assassin's Creed.
You know what sucks is we re-recorded this so many times, and it was because we didn't even say that word the last time, and it still screwed us. So this time we're just saying it.
We just say it over and over and over again.
Over and over and over again. Well, we're not in a theater, you know? Although we are in the theater of the mind.
I guess you could bleep it every single time.
Maybe I will, just to be on the safe side. Thanks, Patrick. Oh, actually, one more thing I would say is that I think a time that would make a lot of sense to cover it.
Yes.
Is
I know
after
you're gonna say.
Drive Away Dolls
right.
comes out.
That's when I want to do it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's still a shoe to drop. There's a bracket, one bracket, opening bracket. Need a closing bracket.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like the science experiment is being run as we speak. There's the control, and then there's the experiment, there's two variables that have been like dropped into two different petri dishes. When we have the results of the complete experiment, I think we will have a lot to talk about in terms of like what does a Joel Coen movie look like versus what does an Ethan Coen movie look like. John Golby, friend of the show, friend of mine from summer camp and college as well. What might the poster for a TTWS film look like? Well, probably not like the website tothewhitesea.com, which has like a guy holding a knife. But Roger Deakins says, even as a joke, it's upsetting to see.
Yeah, I feel like I'm very on the record here. I feel like I'm very on the record here in that I drew the artwork for the podcast, which is, yeah, I mean, that's the poster.
Yeah.
It's Ethan Coen walking through the mountains with a little parachute dragon behind him, you know?
I think what you're saying is there's a version of an amazing film poster that's Brad Pitt with a parachute like walking through some kind of a landscape. Or Brad Pitt hanging from a crane. And it says, to the White Sea.
Well, I mean, I thought about this. I drew Ethan's little face, you know?
Would that be the poster for the film?
I mean, I think I'm on the record about this. Okay, yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I think so I've stated my case. Okay, I actually rendered it and I colored it in. So I think I've spoken my piece.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so that's Ray's version. I think my version, would be similar. It would be Brad Pitt hanging from a crane by a parachute. And it says, to the White Sea in the background. And then there'd be a lot of alternate versions with just, Brad Pitt's face and then, all the side characters, like the Colonel and Arlen and Red. Just taking all the characters who are in the movie for, 4 seconds.
Yeah.
And just putting them in a big, Batman Forever type.
Yeah. Make it look like Expendables.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone we know and love.
Yeah.
The guy with the bento box.
Yeah.
It's often a figure, right? It's often a figure with a bunch of stark empty space around them, right?
Yeah. It's it'll be a figure with stark empty space. And then as the DVD editions come out, they continually overlay characters in helmets on top of that empty space.
Oh yeah. But this sucker is just Brad Pitt's face. The poster is Brad Pitt's face. This movie's so expensive.
Yeah.
What else would you do? Put some dirt on Brad Pitt's face.
Yeah.
He's looking really intense, you know?
I always think of the poster for Children of Men though, where it's just Clive Owen holding a wall. I just something about that poster just didn't work for me. You know what I'm saying?
I have a pitch for a poster.
Okay.
I've never said this before. It's Steve Zahn, action picture, right? Poster is Steve Zahn, the True Lies poster. Just there, you know, holding a gun. And the tagline is, the heat is Zahn.
I love it. Maybe a sequel to The Heat. Where he's the bad guy. Because they're trying to emphasize that there's a guy in this one. John also asks, is the work of the Coens ever nihilistic?
Using the Big Lebowski definition of nihilism?
I would say no. I think that they believe in some things.
What's the difference between being nihilistic and fatalistic?
Fatalistic feels like it's more through behavior, whereas nihilism is having decided that this is something you believe. I feel like fatalism is just sort of but I don't know. I'm not a philosopher. I don't know if there is a philosophy of fatalism. Nihilism feels like more of a philosophy, although I guess not an ethos. I think the Coens believe in drama and storytelling. And they're interested. I think they're interested enough in morality and right and wrong that you can't be that interested in some sort of system of characters being judged or not judged without having some kind of investment in I guess it's an interesting question, right?
They seem super interested in dignity, you know, something really dramatic happening. And at the same time, what's happening is fully stripping the ego or the kind of presentation of the character. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of the times it's tragic things happen to characters with a kind of dull thud. It's not super poignant. And I feel like that's where they get, that's when people go I think these guys are mean. I think they're nihilists because they will take an important character and kind of just put them out like a cigarette butt.
Yeah.
And seem to be super, super cold about it. I mean, Jenkins, Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the trilogy of Richard Jenkins performances?
Let's talk about it. I think this is a great answer, is thinking about Richard Jenkins in all of their movies.
as for nihilism, like nihilism through Richard Jenkins as a human?
Yeah, because of what he represents.
Well, I'll just say the way that he gets like murdered with an axe in Burn After Reading, I think is like, if you want to go like, why do people think they're nihilists? It's because of stuff like that, where it's like that character is really, really likable, really doesn't do anything wrong. There's really no, it's like, why do you do that to an audience? You know?
He's a dope though.
Right. I think that's what, I think they're.
Yeah. He represents a league of morons. Or he represents hard bodies.
I don't exactly know what it is. I think it's enigmatic, you know. Yeah. And I think I think that that's exactly where it lands. Like for people to go, like I don't trust you when you do stuff like that to characters that I'm learning to care about.
Yeah.
But Jenkins, can we just say Jenkins as the drunk in Man Who Wasn't There, the drunk lawyer?
Yeah, the father of Scarlett Johansson.
As the lawyer with the flinchy mouth in Intolerable Cruelty, every time he says something, he kind of winces. Like hearing it out loud. He hates hearing his own ideas said out loud. It's like one of the funniest things ever. And
also given some of the great laugh lines too, like little artsy fartsy.
So funny. Yeah.
Gifted comic actor, gifted dramatic actor, and like a perfect Coen's actor too.
I think underrepresented and under touted as like a reoccurring
Coen's player. Absolutely.
Like just heavy hitting player.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's because people don't like Intolerable Cruelty. I feel like that he's so funny in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, but I think there is something about his character and the way that he.
Well, this is the problem. He gave three great performances in three movies that nobody likes.
Yeah.
He totally did it. He showed up for the ones
for that middle period. Yeah. The post to the White Sea movies. But yeah, I think he's the type of person who Richard Jenkins has a star persona, right? And it's a little pathetic, right? Like in everything that he does. It's a little bit like Bill Macy, too.
They're sad sacks, right? Yeah. Aren't they like technically sad sacks?
I think they are. Yeah, they're in that union.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sad sack union. They're in sad sack. Got there. I think the answer is no.
No.
Yeah.
They're just like, they're allergic to being sentimental in the way that like a lot of other filmmakers think is essential.
Yeah. And you know what else I would say is you go back to what J. Todd said. He said, there's only two things in film and we take this as being something that relates to their work, suspense and surprise. What's the what is the most unsurprising thing in a movie? It's the sentimentality. I just feel like from their perspective, if a character like stands up and gives a really sentimental speech and it's just taken as given, and that's the conclusion of your movie, you fail to surprise the audience. And on the flip side, if you're just continually trying to come up with the most surprising thing that's gonna happen, a lot of that means like breaking the contract with the audience in terms of like who's going to get it and who's not and how. And so you end up with a lot of movies where things happen where the audience is like, you motherfucker, why? It's like, well, because it genuinely surprised you and it's itchy. That doesn't mean that they're nihilists. Thanks, John, for the questions. Thanks everybody for the questions. Hope you enjoyed this mailbag section. We'll do it again sometime soon. Stay tuned for an amazing episode, which we've already recorded and which is going to blow your minds. Have a good one, everybody. Hang in there.
Have a beautiful weekend.
Sending love to you and all your loved ones and everyone who's important to you in your life. The room was humming harder. The ceiling flew away. When we call out for another dream, the waves have brought a train, and so it was a place.
kiss at first, just go to sleep. Turn the wider shade off. Turn the wider shade off fair.